Case number 19-2389, USA v. Devin Lewis. Oral arguments not to exceed 15 minutes per side. Mr. Paul L. Nelson for the appellant.
Good afternoon. Paul Nelson, I represent Devin Lewis, and I have reserved 4 minutes for rebuttal.
Very well, and you may proceed.
Thank you. Devin Lewis seeks review of the denial of his motion to suppress evidence that was obtained during a seizure of him back in October of 2018. The seizure occurred between the hours of 8:30 p.m. and 9 p.m. in Kalamazoo, Michigan. The incident began when a patrol officer who was also had a ride-along with him was driving through Kalamazoo, Michigan, apparently explaining the circumstance or explaining the nature of the area to the ride-along, and passed an alley. And as he passed, he said he saw two kids in the alley. There was no other comment about it at that time, and said that he was going to drive around, essentially drove around the block to look at them. He did drive around the block. He drove up the alley from the opposite direction and drove up on them, had his high beams turned on, exited the car, and at that point said, you know, do you mind if we, can I ask you a few questions, basically? And there was no basis for any suspicion about that. There was suggestions during the course of these proceedings that he suspected that there was trespassing going on or theft going on in the alley, because according to the officer, that alley was a popular spot for that sort of activity. Although later on during the suppression hearing, he testified that he did not see any trespassing going on. That he did, once he got out of the car, he recognized one of the people, a woman, Amber French, who he'd had several run-ins with in the past, and began discussing with her. The other person that was there was Devin Lewis, who merely stood several feet behind Ms. French and basically stood motionless while this was all occurring. Again, the during the course of the initial discussions by the officer was talking about what a high crime area this was generally, that there were a lot of shootings, drug dealing, and so on and so forth. But at that night, there was nothing in the record that indicated that there were any sort of reports of crimes being committed, no shootings, no drug dealing, or anything else in that area. Again, as he mentioned later, that there was no indication that he had, that there was any sort of trespassing going on. And it was clear from the video, the dash cam video or the body cam video, I guess, that the officer wore when he exited the car, that the two people were basically walking down this alley. It's a public thoroughfare, and just slowly walking down.
Counsel,
yes.
Excuse me for interrupting. Just to accelerate this a little bit, did there come a time when the two individuals in the presence of the police reasonably did not feel free to leave the location of that encounter? In other words, so when they might have been seized for Fourth Amendment purposes, and if so, when did that occur?
It's our position that the seizure occurred when the officer exited the car and stood in front of them. I know there was discussion at the suppression hearing and part of Judge Quist's opinion that there was room on either side of the car that they could have walked, or they could have turned around and walked back the other way up the alley. But I think that just really belies the realities of the situation. And there were the other, at least according to the testimony of the suppression hearing, the ride-along who, and I'm not sure, it doesn't say whether he was in uniform or not, also had exited the car and was standing on the other side, the passenger side of the car, it appears. And so in order for either of the two to leave, they would have had to walk by a very close proximity to either the police officer or the second person there. And I think that the, again, the, just the reality of the situation is that in like this, that in an inner city situation, and particularly Mr. Lewis being an African-American man, that when the police start talking to you, that I think it's only reasonable that they would believe that they can't just walk away that, at that time. So it's our position that that was when the seizure occurred.
Well, Mr. Nelson, you know, legally speaking, I mean, from you've pointed to some things that from a practical standpoint might make a reasonable individual decide not to try to leave at any point when talking with police. But legally speaking, that's not how we go about determining when the reasonable person would not have felt free to leave. I mean, the point, there has to be something else other than the police officer talking to you that triggers the not being free to leave in a legal sense. Isn't that the case?
Well, I think that is. But again, I think in the legal sense, the fact that the officer has them blocked in the alley in fairly close proximity, that they cannot, is not reasonably able to leave at that point by walking forward. And again, when the officer instructed Mr. Lewis to remove his hands from his pocket, to basically stand there, I think at that point, any reasonable person would believe that they could not reasonably leave. To be honest with you, I've been in that same situation when just walking down a street and a police officer stopped. And I think it's very difficult to take the position that you are free to leave, that you can just say no thanks and keep on walking.
So you would like the Fourth Amendment law to be that every time a police officer speaks to someone in a public setting, that the person is no longer free to leave.
Well, I think in this, that not necessarily that broad, but in this situation too, it's also important to note that as I looked at the video and doing the math, it was approximately 30 seconds from the time the officer exited the car until he called for backup, which the backup that he had called for, he testified at the hearing, was based on his belief that Mr. Lewis had a gun in his possession. And at that point, I think that although Judge Quist determined that the seizure occurred when the second officer arrived on the scene, I think had Mr. Lewis turned around and walked away, even casually walked away at that point when the officer had called for backup, I think he would have been prevented from leaving.
Well, when, if ever, did your client behave in such a way as to give rise to the reasonable suspicion that would be needed for Terry stop? I know when you say he was seized, but when did your client, if he ever did, engage in any behavior that would have, and I assume it was subsequent to his being seized, based upon what you're telling us, engage in any behavior that would could be deemed suspicious for purposes of a Terry stop?
Well, I know what the police officer says, that there was one apparent, after he told him to remove his hand from his pocket, the police officers testified that Mr. Lewis touched the right side of his coat or his jacket that he was wearing. Although when I look at the video, it doesn't look like he touched the right side, he touched the other side, but he stood there all the time. He was wearing a backpack. He had his hands up in the straps of the backpack, completely open. And he basically stood there immobile during the entire course of the events up until the moment when the police officer grabbed his arm. And
Well, that's not
at that point.
That's not quite the question I was asking you. You're telling me when the police officer might have become more concerned. I was actually asking what's your position as to when your client started to act suspicious, if he ever did.
Well, I don't believe he did anything that was suspicious. I say he was standing basically immobile. He was polite. He was responding to most of the questions and the instructions by the police officer. And he did not take any sort of, make any furtive gestures or anything else. And so at that point, and again, he was not obligated.
Wasn't there at least some testimony that he had discarded something and the police officer thought it was contraband or was suspected that it was?
He did knock something. He had something behind his ear. And I mean, that did come out and it fell down and eventually it fell to the ground. Again, I'm not sure that after the fact, it was determined that that might've been a partial marijuana joint. But what they talked about in the police reports was that he was going to be charged with littering. And so that at that point, perhaps the officer could have asked him questions about what did you do and so on, what was that, something like that. But the officer didn't do that. And he admitted that he was extending the events until the backup officer got there. Okay, so I see my time is up. And
well, all right. We'll hear from the government.
Thank you, Your Honor. Patrick Castle for the United States. I'll just start by addressing what the court was discussing with Mr. Nelson, which is first the time of the seizure, and then we'll move on to reasonable suspicion. The district court correctly ruled that the appellant was not seized when an officer first approached him on a public thoroughfare. As Judge Gibbons correctly identified, the Supreme Court and this circuit have both ruled multiple times that a seizure under the Fourth Amendment does not occur merely because a police officer approaches someone and asks questions. The appellant argues now that it was a seizure because of the nature of the alleyway, and that the appellant wouldn't have felt like he could turn around and walk away or walk past the police officer. First, that is not the test. The test is not whether the appellant felt one way or another. The question is whether a reasonable person in the appellant's shoes would have felt one way or another. That's especially relevant here because, as it turns out, the appellant had a concealed firearm and marijuana. So certainly the appellant probably felt nervous from the outset of the encounter and felt compelled to try to appease the police officer and get away without raising any suspicion from the outset. But that's not the Fourth Amendment test. The Fourth Amendment test is what a reasonable person would feel. And the Supreme Court has ruled in numerous cases that situations far more confining than being in a public thoroughfare did not result in a Fourth Amendment seizure just because police approached someone. So, for example, in the Mendenhall case, the appellant was approached at an airport, a place where most people would feel like if an authority approached them, they're at a greater, they have a greater impulse to cooperate or to do what they're asked to do. In Delgado, INS agents entered a place of work and asked people who were working at their jobs questions about their immigration status. The Supreme Court ruled that just because police officers were in a person's place of work talking to them while they were at work, that wasn't sufficiently confining. So here we are in an alleyway where there was...
Can I ask you a question? I'm curious. So the seizure, I take it your position, it's when the second card came up, when the backup came?
That's
the
right.
Other side of the alley. What about when he was asked, wasn't there a point where the officer was telling him that he was going to run his name or search if he had any outstanding warrants? I mean, isn't the understanding at that point that you can't leave because I'm going to go check on you and you wait here and I'll come back?
No, Your Honor. That was not a seizure because, first of all, taking a look at the totality of the circumstances as is required. A few minutes earlier in that encounter, the officer was speaking to Ms. French, the appellant's companion, whom he knew personally from prior interactions. And he asked her, would you like me to run some warrants on you just so you know what your status is? And if you have any felony warrants, that's not what I'm here to do, is just arrest people on misdemeanor warrants or go after petty things. But if you want to know what your status is with law enforcement, I can determine that. And she said she would like him to do that. So the
Does it make any difference for purposes of the government's position, whether it was at the point Judge Nalbandian suggests or otherwise?
No, Your Honor. In fact, under the Mims case, the Supreme Court ruled that a bulge in a person's pocket, which the officer understood to indicate that that person had a concealed firearm, was sufficient to give that officer reasonable suspicion for a Terry stop. Here, 8 seconds into the encounter, almost immediately after the officer exited the car, the appellant patted the outside of his pocket. There was uncontradicted testimony before the district court that based on that officer's training and experience, he understood that when a person takes their hand out of their pocket and pats the outside of it, that is indicative that that person may have a concealed firearm. Now that combined with the fact of the setting of this case, which is this officer was in a high crime neighborhood. He testified that he had patrolled this neighborhood for 4 years. He was very familiar with it. And he's testified that this particular alley was an alley that was known to be a thoroughfare for individuals who were trying to get away from police, and that it was a high crime alleyway. Now, in the Wardlow case, the Supreme Court ruled that a high crime neighborhood and a headlong flight from law enforcement without more was sufficient to create reasonable suspicion. Here, 8 seconds into the encounter in a high crime area, the officer identified first Ms. French, whom he knew to be a methamphetamine user from previous encounters. And then he asked the appellant to take his hands out of his pocket and saw him pat the outside of it. So even at the outset of the encounter, 8 seconds in, there was reasonable suspicion. And
reasonable suspicion for what? That he was carrying a gun? Is that enough? I mean, in a concealed carry state, is that enough to pat somebody down?
Yes, Your Honor. And actually, this court in the Farrington case, 795 Federal Appendix 404, just last year ruled that under Tennessee law, which has the same statutory structure as Michigan, where having a concealed firearm is generally a felony, but then there's an exception if a person has a permit, this court ruled that the appellant in that case did not challenge and indeed could not challenge that if police suspected that he had a concealed firearm, that would provide reasonable suspicion under that statutory scheme for a Terry stop. The exact same situation applies here. Now, it's true, and I would add to that, Your Honor, that under Michigan law, if a person does have a concealed carry permit, they are required by statute, if they have a firearm with them, to immediately identify to any peace officer the fact that they have a firearm and a concealed carry permit with them.
Now, anybody with a bulge in their pocket in a high crime area can be stopped and frisked?
No, Your Honor. There was an additional factor in this case. The additional factor was the presence of Ms. French. The officer knew Ms. French personally from prior encounters, and he knew that Ms. French was engaged in methamphetamine use. Then about 28 seconds into the encounter, the officer saw the appellant take something from behind his ear and brush it to his shoulder and his lapel, and then brush it to the ground. Now, based on the officer's knowledge of Ms. French and the high crime area and seeing the appellant pat his pocket and identifying potentially a bulge there, the officer concluded that that might have been a controlled substance. The officer thought it might have been methamphetamine because of what he knew about the appellant. So
what did the officer indicate was his reason for initially stopping these people to converse with them? He sees two people on the street there and he decides to stop his car and get out and talk with them. Neither one is committing a crime or engaging in any suspicious behavior. So at the suppression hearing, why did officers say he had stopped these people at the outset?
My recollection, Your Honor, is that he said that he stopped these people because he was patrolling that neighborhood, which is his duty, and he saw two people walking down an alley in a high crime area. So he went to see who they were. Then when he recognized Miss French, he struck up a conversation with her about unrelated subjects. In fact, I agree with Mr. Nelson that for most of the interaction, at least the initial interaction, before a backup officer arrived, the officer was directing his attention almost exclusively to Miss French. Now, he did call for backup about—
That sounds like a statement by the officer that he's entitled to stop anybody he wants to if he considers it a high crime area.
Well, police officers are entitled, Your Honor, I would submit, under the Supreme Court's case law and this circuit's case law, to strike up a consensual conversation with someone, to walk up to them on a public thoroughfare, and to try to engage with them. That, the Supreme Court has ruled, is not itself a seizure under the Fourth Amendment. That's what neighborhood policing is. It's police officers who are assigned to a particular area that they know well, patrolling that area, recognizing people like Miss French, who they've seen before, and striking up consensual conversations with them. Now, this court and the Supreme Court have both held that just because a person might feel compelled to speak to a police officer, that doesn't alone make it a seizure. The question is whether the feeling of compulsion is derived from some show of authority by the officer, or is just derived from the normal feeling that most of us have, that when a police officer comes up to us, we should respond to them and we should participate in the conversation in some way. In the O'Malley case, this court recognized that. And in the Delgado case, the Supreme Court recognized that. And in the Delgado case, as a reminder, that was officers going into a workplace and talking to people. A situation where I would submit the typical person would feel much more unable to walk away than on a public street. But part of this bright line the Supreme Court has drawn is, at least for an initial interaction, unless some of these four indicia of a show of authority are present, it's not a seizure. And none of the indicia of a show of authority were present under the Mendenhall or the Royal cases. There was no threatening presence of multiple police officers until the backup officer arrived. There was no display of a weapon. There was no physical touching. And there was no authoritative language or tone. To the contrary, the officer's tone was incredibly friendly, and his language mostly dealt with other matters. Now, he testified that he had secretly called for backup and didn't immediately confront the appellant because he was outnumbered 2-1, and because he wanted to make sure that he engaged with the appellant, whom he correctly suspected had a concealed firearm, in a manner that would keep everybody in the situation safe. That is responsible policing. That's the kind of decision-making that we want police to be making. And that consensual encounter by approaching these people in this alley and striking up a conversation, it's part of neighborhood policing, but it's also part of an investigative framework under the Supreme Court's precedents, where police can strike up a conversation to try to determine if, based on a limited interaction of a consensual nature, they develop any reasonable suspicion. And it's of no concern to the Fourth Amendment if the officer in his mind thought, part of the reason I want to strike this conversation up is maybe in the course of a consensual conversation, I will develop reasonable suspicion that a crime's been committed. That's conduct that we want police officers engaging in, so long as they're not seizing people before they have reasonable suspicion. And that's not what occurred here. It is okay to walk away from a police officer before reasonable suspicion has been developed. In the Johnson and Beauchamp cases, both out of this circuit, a person walked away from police and they pursued before they had reasonable suspicion. And this circuit ruled that those were violations of the Fourth Amendment.
But you're saying he had reasonable suspicion 8 seconds into this encounter? Or that's— are you saying— Honor. Yes?
Yes, Your Honor, that is my view. However, the court need not find that the first 8 seconds was the point of reasonable suspicion, and that's not what the district court found. The district court found that calculated reasonable suspicion based on everything that occurred from the beginning of the encounter up to the point of seizure when the second officer arrived. And that includes not only the setting of a high crime area and the presence of Miss French, whom the officer knew to be a methamphetamine user and a picker, which is a person who trespasses and steals. He also saw a bulge in the appellant's pocket. He saw the appellant pat the outside of the pocket, which based on his training and experience, he understood meant that the appellant might have a concealed firearm. He saw the appellant dispose of what he thought might be methamphetamine. It turned out to be marijuana.
How soon in did he call for the second car?
43 seconds approximately, Your Honor. So at that point, what had happened was the setting was in place, high crime area, an alley known to be a thoroughfare for criminals evading law enforcement and the presence of Miss French. In addition to that, he had patted his pocket, which the officer understood to be checking for a firearm. He had removed the suspected methamphetamine from behind his ear, and the officer had noticed a bulge or that his clothing was draped in a way that further indicated the presence of a firearm. Now, under Michigan law, possessing a concealed firearm without a permit is a felony. In the Supreme Court's most recent ruling under Terry was Kansas versus Glover in April of this year. And the court ruled in effect that officers are permitted to make reasonable assumptions when they interact with people in the course of developing reasonable suspicion. In that case, the assumption was that the driver of a vehicle that an officer had run the plate for was also the owner of the vehicle, a person whose license had been revoked. In this case, it was reasonable based on all of these indicia of possession of a firearm and of possession of narcotics for the officer to conclude that the appellant was engaged in criminal conduct and to perform a Terry stop at that time. Thank you, Your Honor.
Any rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor, and I'll try to be brief. First, and just to go back again, is in terms of the initial contact, again, as the video shows, the officer pulled into the alley, had the high beams on them, and during the course of these discussions or the course of the contacts, both of them were at various times were shading their eyes to block the bright beams. The officer got out of one side. Apparently, the other person got out of the other side, and it's not there's no indication that he was introduced to someone who was not a police officer. So to reasonable people, it would be that this car is parked there, has them in their high beams, and there are two people blocking their way. And again, as far as the bulge is concerned, the officer testified at the suppression hearing that he did not think that was enough to create reasonable suspicion. That was at pages 35 and 36 of the hearing transcript. So page ID 274-75, that he said that at that point that I'm not sure which way it cuts from the government's point of view, but he said at that point, Mr. Lewis was at that point, Mr. Lewis could just walk away, even though he saw that bulge. As far as padding the pocket, again, recommend that the court look at the video and look at it closely, that he did not pat, as far as I could see, he did not pat the pocket where, in fact, well, the gun was not in his pocket. The gun apparently was in his pants under the right side of his sweatshirt or whatever it was, but that's not where he patted. He patted the other side. He reached across his body to pat. Finally, as far as the factors that the government talks about, again, a high crime area that the courts have said that that's not sufficient. I mean, it's a factor that can be considered, but merely because you're in a high crime area. I mean, a lot of people live in high crime areas, and to suggest that everyone should be suspected of being a criminal merely because they live there where they have to live, that's not sufficient. That the being in the company of Amber French, again, that direct the court to pages 4 through 7 of our reply brief, we cite a lot of cases that mere association with someone who may be even engaged in criminal activity is not sufficient. And here that there's nothing to indicate that she was engaged in criminal activity at the time, and possibly, and I've, as far as I know, the bottle of alcohol that she had under her shirt was not open. And that was, I think there was a comment that it was not open. So that wasn't even a problem that she had an open container issue. But And again, he patted his, whatever he patted, he only patted one time. This was not any sort of continuous thing. And otherwise he stood still. He responded to all of the questions asked by the officer. He did not move. And when he finally started moving, if in fact there was this blading that was talked about, that was in response to the officer coming up and approaching him from his left side, and he just started to back off. So I think under all the circumstances that there was not a reasonable suspicion, there was not grounds for a reasonable suspicion that Devin Lewis was armed that night. And we'd ask the court to reverse the decision of the district court and remand this case for further proceedings.
All right, if there are no further questions, the case may be submitted.